It's those two assholes. Those two idiots you saw me talking to at the third rail.
Just he doesn't want to touch the third rail.
That's, you've hit the third rail for sure.
That is the third rail, saying white people have interest.
Third rail. The third rail here is another wonderful show on our TRS network.
And it's the third rail. You will be destroyed.
It's the third rail. You will be destroyed.
Watch out for the third rail, baby. That's how it folds it.
And the opinion of this reporter, if this nation, or in fact the world, ever needed heroes, that time is now. That time is now.
Like the inevitable rise of the Southern MILF theocracy, this is happening. Welcome to episode 174, 174 of the Dharmic Rights Most Huggable Podcast. Hi, I am your host, Dharma King. To my left, he's the guy who put Nick Land in a headlock and gave him noogies until he admitted that transhumanism is both gay cringe and gay. Dark Enlightenment.
Good morning, good morning, good morning.
To my right, the world's number one connoisseur of souvlaki and redactor of pedophiles. Give it up for Nikephoros.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
And last but not least, his brain is so big, he uses it to crush rocks. Say hello to Kegs for Kavanaugh.
Hail victory.
We're going to get started for you. Have a great show. But first, a word from our sponsor. This episode is brought to you by Bellerophon's forthcoming mixtape, The Yolocaust. Check out the hit singles from the album, including Hitler Is My Nigga, Hebrews Stole the Pyramids from Africa, and the crooning R&B love ballad, Black Guys Should Date Jewish Girls, featuring the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. Available in fine record stores and gas stations near you. Order today.
That's a hot feature on that one.
How y'all doing?
Doing good, man.
Ran out of coffee, so I'm drinking tea like some sort of gay Eastern philosophy Buddhist person.
I'm on my last quarter of this piña colada bang.
Piña colada bang. That sounds delicious.
Oh, it's really good, actually. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. Okay, so what do we got for winners and losers?
My winner of the week is Lindsey Graham and the No Holds Barred Judiciary Committee. That was pretty sweet.
Do you have a loser?
And my loser of the week is Faithful Catholics.
Yeah. Big L. Well, I guess there's some. I heard there's some nuance to that. We'll get to that. We should discuss it. Nike, what are your? Oh, do you have a topic?
Why, despite everything, we should be for Trump.
Okay. We can have that out. All right. Yeah. Nike.
I got a loser, and it's debate watchers, including myself.
All right.
And I've got a topic. Americans are worried about the West, and maybe that's a good thing.
Okay. Interesting. That's an article, I presume.
Yes.
All right. All right. And Kegs.
My winner of the week is the Sackler family. And my loser, and I can possibly combine it, is not necessarily faithful Catholics, but Catlicks.
Catlick. All right. Okay.
The Catholic Church.
Yeah. And my winner and loser are basically the same as DE's. My winner. Well, I guess not the, well, anyway, yeah, my winner would have been Mitch McConnell, which is pretty much the same thing. And, my loser is Tradcaths, for all of the reasons I'm sure going to discuss. And, my topic is the article we didn't get to from last time in the Tablet magazine about the, relationship between David Ben-Gurion and this, Eastern European Jewish monk, we'll get into it. But first, why don't we? Let's go. I think there's a natural progression here. Why don't we first discuss the judiciary stuff, and then we can move into DE, your topic, because I presume that's part of why you think, despite everything, we should vote for Trump.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So why don't you start?
Well, I'm old, and so I can remember like barely the Bork hearings and how ugly the Thomas hearings got. And finally, after Keggs was confirmed last time, that the Republicans have finally decided that actually these Democrats are not colleagues. They're not like my honored colleague from the state of California. You know, like, no, they're assholes who want to destroy you, and you need to act accordingly. And that, I think, is good. Like I'm not, you know, all the reasons that Amy Coney Barrett might be unreliable, and, you know, good Lord, look at what happened last time with Roberts and Gorsuch and, you know, all of that. But it just accelerates the ordinary person's, like, complete disdain and hatred for the media, which is a good thing. So I think putting this woman, who is, you know, by all accounts, like, just like, you know, smart and normal and, you know, according to normie values, like, a decent person. And, like, you know, I mean, like, I'm sorry. No, Maisie Ferno, I know you're like a toad looking Asian woman, but hot redheads don't have to sexually assault people to get them interested. You know, like, you know, so that's just how this works. And I think it was a really good illustration of, like, Kamala Harris was just, like, obviously really jealous and a bitch. And I think it made, like, I put on my Norman glasses for a minute and it looked really good.
Well, I think, please, Kegs. Also, I just want to say, you were talking about the confirmation of Kegs. You know, unfortunately, we got just the original Kavanaugh. I eagerly await Kegs for Kavanaugh joining the Supreme Court. But until then, we have to deal with the lowly.
That's how
Brett.
You know we've won.
Yeah, but anyway, sorry. Go on, Kegs. I just wanted to.
Well, so my own account is kind of a artifact echoing through the ages of the excitement surrounding that hearing, because I created it during the hearing and just never changed the name. I feel like you're being sucked into the Finkel vortex, DE. In fact, the performative outrage of both sides at each other is a negative development, because behind the scenes they have the same agenda, the same donors, and the same masters who are not the American people. This performative act of an utterly meaningless Supreme Court appointment, and I will say it's utterly meaningless, is meant to divide America between red and blue right before an election and distract from the fact that, in fact, nothing is going to change with the Supreme Court. We just had another decision from a rock-ribbed Supreme Court conservative, a Supreme Court that has been conservative since 1992, that Pennsylvania can, in fact, continue to collect ballots for the election 3 days past Election Day. So if our...
Without a postmark, right? Or I don't know. Actually, can you explain that? Because I've seen... It seems like there's multiple decisions, which wouldn't surprise me.
Oh, wow.
What I saw was that Pennsylvania, they were basically saying, like, not only could the signatures, basically they can collect them up to 3 days after the election, number one. Number two, the signature, they just ruled yesterday, as far as I saw, that the signatures don't have to match.
Yeah, and that was Pennsylvania's top court.
And is that, I presume that's statewide and not just for Philly? I mean, not that it would matter, but for Philly, it's statewide.
Yeah, statewide.
Right.
The only possibility is it, like, it's challenged in the Supreme Court, but there's no time for that. It's not going to.
Well, there's going to be Supreme Court. I mean, like, I don't want to necessarily, you know, the obvious play here is for Amy Coney Barrett to side with Roberts and the liberals, or enough of the liberals to, or maybe just, I mean, who knows, but maybe just Roberts will see, to hand the election to Biden. Declining to accept a Trump challenge, or deciding against Trump if they do accept it in a show of whatever, you know, legitimacy and bipartisanship and all that kind of garbage.
Outcome for us.
Destabilizes the system.
I was listening to Ahab's reaction to the debate, and he's like, "I'm not pro Biden. I'm not pro Trump. What I want is the closest chaos. Possible margin and chaos that will delegitimize the system." And
I think the best thing would be a very narrow electoral college Trump win with a massive popular vote disparity. I think that would be the most destabilizing. But because the problem is, if Trump loses, whether sort of by judicial decree or by the actual numbers, or you know, both or whatever, MAGA cucks are not going to do anything. Like, there's no Cumer insurgency coming. There's no, like, the liberals, the left will riot. They've been rioting and they've prepared, and this is basically they're holding the country hostage. That's not an argument to vote for Trump. At least as far as I'm concerned, it's just a statement of fact. Like, the left has made it very clear that the price that the nation will pay if Trump is reelected is, you know, round two or three, depending on how you count, of the BLM riots and burning the cities down and looting and killing people and so on. So, you know, that's not going to happen.
I'll tell you what. The Trump MAGAs won't do anything if Trump is reelected and BLM riots. If Biden steals the election off dead people's votes, though, and it's a razor thin margin, you will see some action. You will see demonstrations. And you might even see some sort of pushback against Antifa if they come out, because Trump is the anesthetic. We've had these riots before. We have leftist riots before. We've had them this past summer and since then. And the right has done absolutely nothing but vote the GOP harder since they've been literally slaughtered in the streets in Oregon and Portland. And I see no reason to assume that that will continue if Donald Trump is elected again.
Yeah, I mean, the way that I see it is, I don't disagree with that at all. I'm curious who is really the accelerationist candidate in that sense, because, you know, Biden's not going to provide any kind of check to Kamala Harris's, you know, vicious anti-white hatred or the agenda, you know, the horrible anti-white agenda of the people behind him and the people that are running the show. The question I have is how to balance that against, or how that would look, you know, against the insane reaction. Cause I mean, you think things are bad now. Imagine if Trump actually does somehow come out on top, just the absolute rage and violence and complete mental. I mean, they're already basically in a state of having broken down from any contact with reality, but I feel like it can still get a lot worse, and it will if Trump wins. I feel like that could be valuable too, you know?
I think that you've hit upon a novelty take here, which is that the parties and the candidates here are just so indistinguishable in effect from our concerns that both are accelerating in their own way.
Here's why, like, despite everything, and I guess I can fold this into my topic here, why I think that Trump, like a vote for Trump, and particularly in places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, whatever, is still a valuable thing. Okay. The average normal person who listens to Rush, okay, these are not bad people. All right. They're decent people, and they just don't know. And for most of us, we were there 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, whatever. And it took something. For me, it was watching Ron Paul just get destroyed in 08, despite being, you know, in my mind, the best candidate. And being exposed to a Mitch's mold bug and other things. And obviously we've grown past that, but okay. The failure of the Trump administration to do what we want it to do does not mean that the Trump administration has failed to deliver. Like, you know, normie conservative housewives are like, he's done a lot on human trafficking, and he's done this and he's done that. And despite everything, to see the left lose their minds, burn stuff down, hate people, openly say, we hate you because you're white, which is what they're doing. That will be valuable, I think. The outright racial animus.
But I mean, the counter argument, I kind of agree, but to play devil's advocate, the counter argument is they're already doing that, and Trump already isn't doing anything about, I mean, there's nobody doing anything about it. So, like, what more do you want?
Yeah, the point was Kamala Harris won't provide or Biden won't check Kamala Harris's anti-white agenda. Donald Trump can't check the anti-white agenda. I have very few optimistic inclinations as to what Donald Trump's second term would be, because this is the Donald Trump that is pandering to white people because he needs our vote. What's he going to do when he has the platinum plan implemented in the second term?
Yeah.
I think
come on, man.
This is the first time in my life that I expect any second term to be weaker than the first. You know, it's usually you consider it to be the opposite. Like, second term is when you have nothing left to lose, so you can go all out on your agenda.
That's true. And all of those criticisms, like, I'm not disagreeing with any of you guys' criticisms. I'm just going to say that, like, I think Donald Trump not openly hating guns and not openly hating working class people, like, we could argue justifiably that, you know, he has not done much, but and then despite everything, I think that for ordinary people, and you know, I saw one of these like Hispanics for Trump's thing, and there's all these like, you know, like cured leather looking skin dudes talking about how like he's against pedophiles. Like 5 years ago, if you'd said, hey guys, did you know that the news is run by satanic pedophile communists? They'd have been like, what? And now you're like, hey guys, did you know that all the news media is run by, you know, by a bunch of satanic pedophile communist Satan worshippers? And they're like, well, yeah, you know, so the arc of history is long, but it bends toward vindicating Alex Jones. And
so true.
But I think that is valuable. I don't want Donald Trump for what Donald Trump has done. I want Donald Trump for what he does to other people.
Yeah, I'll say this. I mean, you know, I said this on Twitter a little while ago, but I mean, just to repeat, I don't know that I would say that I would vote for Trump. I personally, and again, don't take this please the wrong way, as you know, I think, you know, with all the standard qualifications and so on. I have personally been Finkelthinked, I guess you could say, into like, I am going to vote for Trump specifically because the worst people who have ever existed in the history of humanity, literally the worst people who have ever existed, tens of thousands of years, we had anatomically modern humans, the absolute dregs, bottom of the barrel, worst of the worst, extreme far left tail of the distribution, are in control of our society and hate people like, you know, people like us, normal people, man. White people. Well, the bottom line is making them feel mental anguish is a positive good. And so I had intended to like write in Mike Enoch, and I fully intend to vote for the NJP when the NJP is on the ballot. I think that will send a very, very clear message, and that will be a very scary message when they see 10 or 100,000 or God knows how many, you know, the people voting for the NJP in like, act, you know, when they're actually physically on a ballot and you can cast a ballot without having to write something in. That will be huge. In the absence of that, at this particular moment, I'm not voting for Trump. Fuck Donald Trump. I don't give a shit about Trump. I don't care. I don't really care that much if he loses. Except insofar as mental anguish that could have been inflicted on my enemies will not have been inflicted.
Co-sign that, yeah.
It's a good perspective, I suppose. I think it could be summed up as to own the libs.
Yes.
Yeah, owning the libtards, exactly. And you're not going to own the libtards by staying home is kind of at this point, right? Like, I don't know. I fully admit, like, mea culpa, I have been Finkelthinked. Like, seeing this stuff with, I mean, you know, I mentioned this last week, and I'll say it again. The existence of China is not an existential threat to Western civilization. Chinese civilization and Western civilization can coexist. In the past, have coexisted. The existence of Israel is an existential threat to Western civilization. We can't, Western civilization will disappear or the state of Israel disappear. We cannot coexist. Okay. So from that perspective, Like, you know, at a certain level, it's like, okay, well, who cares about China? I get that. And I don't entirely disagree. However, China is our number one geopolitical rival. The battle for the future in practice is a battle between Western civilization, Aryan man, whatever you want to call it, white people. The struggle for global supremacy is a struggle between the Chinese and the Europeans, period.
That's kind of a good segue, actually, if you want to.
Okay. Well, just to close the point out, like this stuff with Biden, like I know I don't want to like get too in the weeds, and I'm sure jazz hands would be like, oh, you're just getting finked. And I fully acknowledge it at some level I am. Nevertheless, like if you're following the story, which I don't necessarily recommend that you do, but if you are, it's very clear, like, you know, this isn't some innocent garden variety corruption. Like the stuff with Ukraine, it's just garden variety corruption, kickbacks, who cares? The stuff with China, we're talking Chinese state military intelligence funneling tens of millions of dollars into the pockets of Joe Biden. Like that is a legitimate national security problem. I don't care if you're a dissident, you think politics is fake. Politics is fake and gay.
You know what? You know what Chaz Hintz would say?
Please.
What?
You know what the shot is? At least the corruption that the Bidens did in China was in China. Jared Kushner and Donald Trump.
Sure. Yes, that's a good
cash
point.
From Chinese billionaires to funnel
To Israel, EB5 right?
Visas to the United States. So what personally affects you more? You know, the Chinese getting the blueprints to the F-35, which is a piece of shit, or the Chinese bribing Jared Kushner to come up and buy all the real estate in your local metropolitan area where all the jobs are anyway?
Right. I guess my point is I think there's a temptation to overly downplay the yellow peril. And I want to resist that temptation. That's really my only point. My main point, I guess. Not my only point, but my main point is I don't want to downplay the yellow peril too bad, because I think in the like long run, I could be wrong, but the way I see it, like Israel has a really tough road ahead. And I think with a kind of 100 to 200 year horizon, Israel kind of isn't going to be that much of a problem anymore. But with like a kind of 200 to 500 year horizon, China is what we need to watch out for. And I don't want to lose sight of that. I could be wrong. It could be the other way around. Who knows? But these are definitely both threats and definitely both things that we need to be paying attention to. Nikkei, okay. You wanted to, you had a segment.
Speaking of Western civilization, I wanted to give more love and attention to our friend Aris Roussinos from unheard.com. He got very, very high praise on the most recent Strike and Mike. Listen to it, get behind the paywall. They go through one of his recent articles. So I figured I'd continue the love train because I've appreciated his work for a long time. Read you guys another one of his recent posts. And it's titled, Americans Are Worried About the West, and Maybe That's a Good Thing. It's fair to say that a certain civilizational consciousness is in the air at the moment. As I've argued and unheard recently, the rising powers of Eurasia are increasingly using a rhetoric of following their own unique civilizational special paths to justify their increasingly open divergence from liberal norms. Similarly, there seems to be a growing fashion in publishing, always a bellwether for the concerns of the moment. For books on civilizational collapse, or the collapse in question is those of society's past, like the enjoyable new book on Alaric the Goth, or of our own, like the newly translated How Everything Can Collapse. One way or another, a certain Spenglerian gloom is wafting through the cultural ether. It's extremely interesting, then, that in our exclusive unheard/focal data poll of American voters, 68% claim to be worried to some degree about the decline of Western civilization. This doom-laden sentiment doesn't seem to be strongly associated with any particular level of educational attainment, being shared more or less equally across all levels of education. If anything, the most striking result is that those with less than ninth grade degree of education who disagree most strongly with 19% firmly rejecting the idea. Similarly, with those strongly agreeing, clustering around the 30% mark across all levels of household income, concerns over the survival of Western civilization doesn't seem to be firmly associated with this particular social class either. Broken down by racial categories of the United States Census, we see that 31% of whites strongly agree, compared to only 20% of Hispanics. But even here, the gulf isn't as great as it first may seem. When we add in those who mildly agree, the gulf is only between 71% of whites broadly in agreement against 65% of Hispanics. Similarly, 62% of Asians and 63%, I believe he meant to say of blacks, are worried about the decline of Western civilization to some degree. So what's going on? You would no doubt expect these sentiments to be strongest amongst Trump voters. And indeed, 40% of 2016 Trump voters strongly agree compared to 28% of Clinton voters. But their currency across all racial and class divisions and all degrees of educational attainment indicate something much bigger is going on. This doesn't seem to be some kind of racial or cultural dog whistle, as you might first expect. Nor, given its spread across educational levels, does it seem to be some kind of snobbish protest over declining cultural or educational standards. If anything, there's a degree of hope here. Given the months of increasingly violent protests over statues and over America's European heritage in general, you'd expect a topic as potentially combustible as Western civilization to be a much more contentious issue. Yet Americans are broadly in agreement, going against all potential fault lines on worrying over its survival. Perhaps Western civilization is such a broad and nebulous concept that it can unite conservatives, worrying about immigration or statue toppling or the 1619 Project, with liberals, in the American sense, worried over democratic norms. That Western civilization can be seen by American conservatives as something threatened by China's rise and by liberals as threatened by Russian election meddling. In an election period marred by violence and increasingly escalatory rhetoric by both sides, in a country increasingly torn apart by issues of race and culture, you wouldn't expect so many American voters to be united, rather than divided, by worries about this particular question. Like the barbarians in Cavafis' famous poem, whose threatened arrival brought the squabbling citizens of his unnamed Roman city together to wait for their own conquest, perhaps the fear of its loss is some kind of solution.
Yeah, I mean, there's a long history of, you know, the end is nigh, and millenarian anxieties have been around a long time. But
I mean, there's a lot of good evidence.
Yeah, well, you have to be kind of just stupid, frankly, or to not. I've been having some version. I haven't quite found the right words to put this out there yet, but. I think everyone kind of feels we're approaching some kind of crisis, or we're in a crisis. We're approaching some kind of catharsis, or at least some kind of climax. You know, whether it'll be a kind of relative climax or an absolute climax, who knows? These things move in cycles, and you know, often are hard to ascertain, except in retrospect. You know, thinking about 20th century history in a lot of ways, I mean, I think it's clear that our New World Order really wants to set 1945 as the year, has set 1945 as the year zero. That's, you know, history begins in 1945, their history, the kind of the history of the new man that they want to create. But I think in a lot of ways, a more objective look is that, you know, the world ended in 1917. It wasn't 1945. You know, World War II is a second act to a process that, like, the important stuff kind of all happened 30 years prior to that. And yes, it was extremely destructive and millions of people died. But in terms of the kind of grand historical sweep, I think we're already at a place where serious historians, and this isn't original to me, I got this from Bulbug, and he wasn't the first to come up with it either. Like, World War I and II you could think of it like a second 30 years war, right? And it just kind of dragged on, but the outcome didn't change from 1917, and the contours were all set then, and that's when the world as it had existed came to an end. And I don't know that we're I don't know, you know, who knows what the future will hold, but I definitely think if you're not of the opinion that Western civilization is collapsing, you're just not paying attention, frankly.
And it's interesting to see that apparently a lot of Americans are paying attention. Like all Americans, really.
Well, as I said, you know, I was talking with a friend of mine that I hadn't seen in a while, who's, you know, kind of standard issue libtard, but a smart person and a reasonably kind of intellectually honest person. And, you know, when I cut through the kind of, like, I didn't even talk in terms of partisan politics. I, you know, I made it clear that my contempt for the Republicans, which is, I guess, good enough for him. And I said, you know, you got to understand, you know, I think everybody understands the Republicans are the party of white people. He's like, yeah, nodding his head. That's true. You know, nobody wants to say it, at least of all the Republicans, but that's sort of de facto what the thing is. And so the dividing line, we were talking about the collapse, and I said, you know, he's like, he was putting it in political terms, essentially. He's like, I see, you know, the tension is partisan. I'm like, it's not partisan, it's racial. And partisanship is a proxy for race. And Republican identification is a proxy for whiteness. And the Republicans don't like that. Nobody likes that. I mean, it's, you know, very uncomfortable and makes people kind of, you know, feel icky in their tummy to think about, especially, you know, number one, people that feel, I just lost all patience with the Republicans who don't want to face it, but it's true. Everybody knows that that's true. That's why the Democrats are the way they are and treat them the way they do. But, you know, we're in the looting phase of a collapsing empire. And, you know, this is a 100% libtard, like Trump is a white supremacist type guy. And he's like, yeah, you're absolutely right. The American empire is collapsing and we're in the looting phase. So, like, you don't have to be even like right wing or anything to be able to see that.
And in fact, some of the best people to talk to about these sorts of things are people that we completely disagree with. So, like, I regularly listen to Jimmy Dore's show because Jimmy Dore is an honest guy on the left. Glenn Greenwald is an honest guy on the left. Wendy, she was just on Ralph's show. She's been talking about some of the stuff going on in South America. I can't remember her name. She's a journalist down there and on the left. Anybody who can see it, right? The problem we have and is the system itself. You know, the problem with the Finkelthink is that, you know, Obama was a Kenyan communist. And like, well, yeah, he was, but he didn't do anything. Like, if he was genuinely a man of the left, then things would have been, like, actual things would have gotten done.
Yeah, it would have been a lot worse.
Well, not only a lot, in some ways it would have been better, right? Like, he would have just nationalized the healthcare system. Oh. You know, like, if he was genuinely a man of the left, he would have just said, like this is ridiculous that the Sacklers can make a gazillion dollars off the backs of, like, suffering people and keep all the profits for themselves and impose all these costs on the society. And
if that's the level of genuine leftist we're talking about, then the presidency is out of the question.
Yeah, that's true. But that's because the system itself is illegitimate and it's set up to loot middle class white people.
Yes.
So,
well, I can talk about the looting of white people by the Sackler family. And the wonderful job,
excellent segue,
Trump, yes. Department of Justice, and that is essentially that this new plea deal. So the Trump Department of Justice, you know, the clock's ticking down on the Trump administration. I think they're going to lose. I think the Trump Department of Justice thinks he's going to lose because they're running to the door. You know, and on their way out the door, they're grabbing like a shoplifter. They're grabbing everything they can get their hands on. You know, and this is like a particularly sparkly dress they get their paws on as they book themselves out of the TJ Maxx, and that's on their agenda, and that's settling the opioid lawsuit. And this has been something that's been on quite. Going on quite a while back when Eric Stryker first wrote about this for the Traditionalist Workers Party and the Traditionalist Workers Party newspaper to give you a sense of how long ago this started and how long ago certain people have had their eye on this. When Stryker started working on this, there were about 250,000 deaths from opioid overdoses. When I wrote my last article on this for John Q. Publius's Anatomically Correct Banana, and that was not this summer, but the summer before. There were 400,000 opioid-related deaths, and today there are 470,000 opioid-related deaths. So the number is still going up. It's still going up rapidly. And what's on Trump's agenda? It's to settle this Sackler case before the Democrats get in and possibly ask for more money. Because that's who Trump answers to. He's not, his DOJ isn't spending their last days, you know, prosecuting Antifa. They're spending it, given Sackler's a sweetheart deal. And that deal is, well, first the headline is Sackler guilty plea for Purdue Pharma pleads guilty to criminal charges. And that's just stupid. It's
nobody's going to jail.
No one's going to jail. The company pleads guilty to a criminal charge. And that's just a headline. And what they do is the Sacklers, the company has agreed to pay about $8 billion to the federal government. And the Sacklers are going to pay from their own personal wealth out of the magnanimity of their hearts, $225 million from their personal wealth after transferring from the company $11 billion. And you may say, hey, that $8 billion, it's still a lot of money. They'll probably use it for, you know, opioid relief or whatever. Well, there's a limited pot of money because Purdue Pharma's in bankruptcy. So Purdue Pharma says, hey, we only have $10 billion in assets that we can set aside for settlements. That's their proposed number. It's probably slightly higher than that. But what this is the federal government moving fast, moving quickly after states and counties and tribes have fought for years in the courts to force Purdue into a settlement. Because the federal government's so corrupt and so willing to deal with these criminals, now literal criminals, they can come in and settle for $8 billion out of that $10 or $12 billion pool in assets. And let's say we allow Purdue Pharma to go into bankruptcy. Let's say, hey, you know, we'll respect the corporate veil, this principle of the free market, that we won't touch the Sackler assets. At least the assets that remain in Purdue's coffers should be directed more towards the states and the counties and the municipalities and the tribes, because they have the best, they're more connected and more better able to deploy opioid-related relief and treatments. What the federal government is going to do with that $8 billion is it's MMT money. They've got the money printer. They don't need that money. They're just going to burn it to reduce the inflation created by the other money they're printing, essentially, if you follow MMT. But because counties and states and tribes don't have the money printer, they could have used those billions of dollars to actually, in effect, provide treatment they otherwise could have. But now that $8 billion is going to be thrown in the same general pot with F-35s for Israel and all the wonderful things our federal government spends its money on. And this is why the Trump administration is so insidious, because the evil they do is very effective. And the stuff that they don't do and they're very ineffective with, like immigration removals, eats up all the headlines where compare this opioid settlement for an issue that's killed 470,000 Americans, primarily white Americans, how much attention that gets compared to, you know, the kids in cages meme.
Yeah. Damn. That's extremely depressing. Thank you.
Fuck the Sacklers.
Well, I mean, again, you know, like Borzoi said, in a sane society, you know, we have ways of dealing with these people that we're not going to discuss on air. I think everybody understands what the kind of appropriate response in a sane society would be. But we don't live in, we live in clown world, piss earth, hell realm. And yeah, so these people get to pay whatever, you know, a month's worth of revenue, and that's it. They're in the clear.
One day we'll have our national justice.
Oh, we certainly will. Yeah, I have no doubt of that.
God will vindicate us, no doubt.
Yes.
Amen.
And here's the thing about, as bad as all that is, and believe me, I'm like, it's in both infuriating and just saddening at the same time. They're never going to be able to get away with this again. Never.
No, yeah, right. No. The cat's out of the bag now. That's part of, yeah, please go on.
Like worldwide, you know, the 110 never again. Like, no, like every, the only group of people who are on the whole not Jew-wise are Europeans, particularly Western Europeans and Americans. And it's through the media hegemony and cultural hegemony that we have. That we, you know,
which is already breaking down, but
which is breaking down, and
yeah,
and it is only, you know, Mike talks about this all the time, like biological anti-Semitism, religious anti-Semitism isn't the problem, political anti-Semitism, where we're just like, no, you know, there's a rule we have, where just, you're a Jew, you can't serve in Congress, you can't serve on boards, you can't serve because you're a Jew, and like, you can't own companies. Boom. You know, and someday stuff like this is going to be like, you know what happened last time we let them own a company that killed 300,000 people.
Yeah. Well, I think the long-term solution, like, I, you know, as Mike is often points out, like, you can't, irrespective of your ethical feelings about it, you know, the memes about gas chambers are funny, but that kind of an approach is not, it's going to create more problems than it solves. The way to do it is you ban kosher slaughter, you ban infant circumcision, you ban synagogues, you ban the Talmud, you keep one copy kind of locked away as a reminder. You make it, you do to them, you take a kind of legalistic approach and you make it functionally impossible for them to organize racially, and that's it. You don't need really anything else. You know, lots of religions have died. There's no need to like take a kind of heavy-handed approach. You can be very humane and very, you know, all of this kind of stuff. There's no need to do anything other than say, like, this thing you call a religion, this global domination strategy that you've put together, it's very effective. We're not going to let you do that anymore.
See, I disagree. I endorse the strategy of Eric Stryker, which is to, quote, throw them off the cliff they're trying to throw us off of. Send them to Madagascar, lock it down, and then flood it.
To be clear, in those terms, no, not Madagascar. I think Israel. Send them all to Israel and then let Iran, you know, have just like cut off all aid and put them all in Israel. That's, I mean, in those terms. But like, you know,
take its course.
Right. Exactly. There's no need to, I guess my point is there's no need to like for any kind of heavy handed measure. We can expulsion is Lindy. Expulsion of the Jews in particular is extremely Lindy.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, and
I never thought of it like that, but technically correct.
Yeah. So, you know, that's not. But that's ultimately, I think, what's going to have to happen. And that's why, I mean, to circle back to what I was saying before, and exactly, I agree with you, DE, like, the there is no scenario here where, like, I mean, I guess, you know, it can be helpful to consider what it is they have planned for us, what they want for us, which is, you know, kind of tiny little elite in Zion ruling over the rest of humanity that has been kind of crushed into this caramel slurry and serving as their slaves. I just don't think that's not going to happen. Like, I don't think the conditions are in place for that. I don't think that's going to happen. I don't, you know, it's what they want. It's what they're working towards. And they're going to do, they are doing and have done unspeakably evil things to to try to accomplish that. But at the end of the day, it's just not going to work. It's just not happening. And the end result is that their crimes are being exposed for all of humanity to see. They're pissing absolutely everyone off. And yeah, I'm optimistic about the long run here. And I'm not even that long of a run. I don't see how this criminal enterprise continues past another 100, 200 years or so. But I don't know. Who knows?
I don't even think it can. I don't think it can. In a real sense, their biggest problem is they bought their own bullshit. Like, if they in an America that's like increasingly less white, increasingly less competent, increasingly corrupt, increasingly the Biden levels of corruption are astonishing for like an Anglo-Saxon people. That's like, holy cow, you know, but they're normal in Hispanic countries. Yeah. You know, they're normal.
What's the difference now?
Right. Yeah. But what's the difference now?
Politicians rape children. Like, I'm past caring about some dude taking money from China.
but he also raped kids. Let's not kid ourselves here. Like
he covered for his son raping his granddaughter. Let's be real clear about that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's pretty fucking awful, man. And yeah, I mean, just, yeah. Here's that sort of crap is normal in, say, Latin American countries. Maybe not the raping the granddaughter thing. That's pretty fucking heinous. Only amongst Jews is that sort of shit normal. But the staggering levels of like, you know, bribes and that sort of stuff is pretty normal everywhere else in the world. And it was only the high trust and, you know, relatively high velocity of commerce, trust, money, etc., that allowed the Anglo-Saxon to rule the world. And now that our society is no longer an Anglo-Saxon society, we're not going to be able to do it. We're just not going to, you know, and these Jews have said, you know, like, oh, well, we can totally, you know, replace, you know, these 110 IQ WASP Episcopalians with, you know, 93 IQ, you know, Guatemalans, and everything will work the same. Like, no, that is not how this works. Mm. And so their system is obviously crashing. I mean, you know, we're at the looting phase of the end of the empire.
So, and when people say the replacement is just to have a more pliant and docile, non-threatening demographic arrangement, what do you say to that? Because what you just said seems to sound like, you know, they thought they could just replace and it would be the same.
I think they think it'll be that way, but they didn't. They bought their own bullshit about, you know, human neurological and, you know, uniformity, and they bought their own bullshit about equality, and that's gonna, you know, bite them in the ass.
Okay.
I don't think they believe in equality. I mean, I don't think they believe in these things. I think they're absolutely cynical. And yeah. When I hear things about they bought their own bullshit,
I've been more the same mindset there, that I think they've always seen this as here's people who are less threatening long-term. If we just tell everybody, you know, let them in because of equality, then that's how we can establish this. Maybe not necessarily because they believe that as a scientific truth.
Well, speaking of God's chosen people, let's talk about God's real chosen people, the Catholics. And I think we had several individuals who wanted to bring this up.
Well,
there's a documentary that just came out called Francesco, where the Pope, no matter what the like grasping at straws traditionalists have said, you know, endorsed civil unions for queers.
So what part wasn't true and what part literally was true?
Well, he when he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires in Argentina, he advocated for civil unions for homosexuals. He mentioned that, and he said something I supported it then and I support it now. And in this biography that's coming out. And what's interesting is, you know, if you're like me and you just don't care about the guy because you think he's an anti-pope and you ignore him, then meh, you know, oh, hey, look, he just confirms that I'm right about him being a terrible person. Okay, moving on. What this has done is put the establishment right inside the Catholic Church on the back foot, perhaps permanently. You know, he's been nothing but, you know, who am I to judge? And, you know, all of these other things that he's done as quote unquote the pontiff have really kind of messed with people. And they're constantly trying to, you know, translation, you know, like the divorce and remarried thing, or the, you know, all of the holes below the waterline he's put inside this whole, like we can reconcile with liberalism post Vatican II conservative theology. He's wrecked it. And, much like in the political sphere, people have slowly woken up to the fact that there's certain people we just can't get along with. In the religious sphere, you know, people are waking up to the fact that there's certain ideas that are just wrong. And Francis has wrecked a bunch of people, and unfortunately a lot of people have lost their faith because of this sort of stuff. And that's tragic. But it is good insofar as it like just confirms what everybody already knows, that he's a leftist, that, you know, that there's no way to reconcile traditional teaching with leftism.
Hmm. So all this came out this week, right? Earlier this week?
Yeah, like Wednesday, I think, Tuesday.
So, you know, when you go to church on Sunday, let us know how many more people, if any, you notice at your particular parish, as opposed to, you know, every week before that. I want to see, like, how many people, like, immediately make the switch to a more traditional parish.
I will keep you informed. But, yeah, it's clarifying, and that's so far as it's good, I guess. Is at least there's that.
Have you seen reactions like this before?
Oh, yeah. Many times, and there's a half a dozen incidents in the, you know, so-called Pontificate of Francis that have had led to similar things. It's yes. Just that this is
egregious.
This is especially egregious. This is really bad. You know, this is him.
You know, the Cope posters are just as bad, man. Like the worst one I saw was like explaining that the translation from what he said in Spanish is really, you know, not civil union, but cohabitating. Like, nigga, I'm pretty sure you Catholics think it's bad for straights to do that too.
Yeah, yeah, like...
The only thing worse than straight cohabitation is gay cohabitation. And he's saying, oh, that's okay.
Yeah, yeah, no, it's pretty bad.
Like, worst fucking cope I've ever heard.
Oh, yeah, and on the plus side, these internet autiste Catholics who, you know, like, guys, just shut up, please, just be quiet, please stop, get off of twitter.com, go outside, talk to an actual girl, and stop trying to like relentlessly infight with like ortho bros or presby bros that you agree 99% on everything, and then you're like, but you're wrong about the filioque, so I have to completely do nothing but bother you all day with how you're wrong. Like, guys, shut up. Just deal with your own problems.
Do not reply to the filioque threads.
I leave for 1 minute and we're arguing about theology. Nice.
No, we're not. Actually, we're all in agreement. Consensus here. Gay marriage bad. That's the consensus.
Oh, okay. So we already covered that's great. Yeah. Yeah. I'm sorry, Kath. I'm really, I don't know. Yeah. It sucks. I don't know what else to say.
Ah.
So what's next on the agenda? So we had our loser Catholic Church, winner Sacklers.
You wanted to talk about conservatives on Parler. Is there some development?
Oh, well, I know we're doing a short episode today, so this was just kind of a throwaway. Where now the AH boys, the comfy chair enjoyers, are on Parler, and there's been some concern trolling about Parler. You just need to put in a burner number to get on Parler, and as a result, you can say literally whatever the hell you want.
Do Google Voice numbers work?
Google Voice works for me. I've heard even the online, you know, fake website numbers work because they had the worst H-1B contractors design this thing. It's the mobile app, at least, is absolutely Pajit tier, but it's really enjoyable to go after these people with just, you know, middle finger Pepes up.
I see. So conservatives on Parler are taking the L in the sense of like they're getting dunked on.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, definitely do that. I had like the sign up window open and I just haven't. But yeah, let's all get on Parler and see how long the good times last. It'd be funny. I mean, I know Twitter is poised to they're going to start cracking down on Holocaust fact checking. Interesting question, I guess, if you know what, how that's going to look with Parler, but definitely we should force them in a position where they say like, yeah, you have First Amendment rights and you can even say the gamer word, but you can't do this one other thing. That would be an interesting position for them to be in for sure.
Yes. One specific topic that is taboo among others.
So yeah, that's a good thing. Okay, well since we are running a bit of a short show today, I thought I would talk a little bit about this article that Borzoi turned me on to. So thanks Borz for that. And this is a very kind of revealing thing. It's called The Dharma of David Ben-Gurion, and it's a look at the relationship between one of the most important founding figures of the modern state of Israel and a Theravada Buddhist monk who grew up in Austria, who is an ethnic Jew. I don't know if there's necessarily a whole lot to say here, but I do think it's interesting. And I have a couple points that I'd like to make, and it actually ties back into the previous discussion of Bergoglio and the whole kind of mess in the Catholic Church. So I'll just start because the first paragraph is it kind of rustled my jimmies to start with. It starts, among the many intriguing global alliances of the late 20th century, the one between Israel and India has been one of the more compelling. Now, I think, like, just to jump in here already, like, there's a lot going on just with that statement. People may not know this, you know, but both Israel and India in the middle part, immediately after the end of the Second World War, were kind of nominally non-aligned, but within the broader sphere of the Soviet Union. Israel in particular was heavily, I mean, it was obviously kind of Bolshevik from the start. I mean, these people are all, you know, the Bolsheviks were Jews, and but there was a heavily Marxist ethic to the extent that the kibbutzes, these kind of, you know, compounds, these socialist compounds, which is what the modern settlements grew out of, were an explicitly Marxist communist enterprise. And it was only after the Soviet Union really started cracking down on Jews. I mean, I guess that would happen a little bit later. It was all kind of part of the same thing, though. And there were contemporaneous developments where the geopolitical entity, the Zionist entity, the state of Israel, started moving closer to the United States as the Soviet Union started dealing with its Jew problem. India has not had a Jew problem, but it was kind of like, for complicated geopolitical reasons, more within the orbit of the USSR, And then that has really only in the past couple of years, I mean, not obviously the USSR stopped existing long before that, but in the past, like because of the close military relationship between the United States and Pakistan, you know, India has been very, very wary of the US and only very recently has started expanding those ties, despite the fact that the American military relationship with Pakistan continues. Anyway, I'll go on. This is a gem. Both states gained their independence at about the same time. Yes. India gained its independence from the British, you know, empire, which we can say that was a good, you know, we could say there's bad things about that or whatever, but at least you could say that that's an independent. To talk about like, yeah, Israel just sort of gained its independence from what, faggots? All right. Both understand themselves to be fragile yet vibrant democracies surrounded by hostile Muslim states. Yeah. I mean, it's just, yeah.
Yes, these are the same thing.
Right. In addition to the political similarities, the mutual cultural fascination has lasted decades. In Israel, ashrams, meditation centers, and teachers of both Hindu and Buddhist traditions are a common part of the cultural scene, and India remains a top travel spot for young Israeli soldiers spending some time downtime after our army service. Now, I can speak to this personally. You know, no docs, but
suck as tourists.
Well, yes, but. Is what it is, what they're talking about is sort of like very, very kind of how to say, oblique reference, but like anyone who spent, if you spent time in Dharamsala or like, you know, the certain kind of like these big Buddhist Tibetan Buddhist kind of exile Tibetan holy spots in India, there are a bunch, especially in the kind of foothills of the Himalayas, there are tons of Israelis, especially, yeah, like immediately, they shoot a bunch of Palestinian children, they have horrible PTSD, and they just obliterate themselves, self-medicating with marijuana.
Vacation.
Yeah, they literally just go and like chill out, smoke a bunch of weed, and hang out around Buddhist monasteries in Dharamsala. That's like a very, like any, I mean, I, like anyone who's been there can tell you this. It's not like me saying this. But yeah, it's like, yeah, I gotta, you know, decompress after murdering all these innocent civilians. Dissertation.
Do they do tipping in India?
Not so.
Wait a second.
If they do, the Israeli tips have to be the worst.
Yeah, no, there's nobody tips anyway. It's not a thing. So yeah.
Okay. So I have a question, sir.
Yeah.
So you would think, right? Judaism, I mean, it's really actually only like, what, 1,700 years old. But, you know, they say that their religious tradition is 2,700, you know, like really old and ancient and stuff. And that killing your tribe's enemies is the highest good. And yet all these Israelis have to go to a Buddhist monastery. Why is that? Like, you would think Judaism would have a mechanism.
Have the resources, right? Yeah, have the spiritual resources to provide.
Yeah. It'll tell us after, you know, like, there's parts of the Old Testament, like after you've killed people, you have to, like, you know, you have to wait a week to come back into the camp sort of thing. Like, you would think that the Jews, but nope. It is not a religion. It is just an ethnic racket.
Yep.
Because if it wasn't that, they'd have their own rabbis and they'd go up to, you know, wherever the Mac, I can't remember the name of the Mac, you know, where the Maccabees were. And they'd like sit for a week and contemplate what they'd done. And then they'd be like, I did the right thing. And then they'd go on with their day. But nope, they got to go to India and smoke a bunch of weed and like culturally appropriate the Buddha.
Yep.
These fucking people, man.
Yeah. Yeah. It's anyway, I just that really jumped out at me because I was like, oh, I know what you're talking about, but you're kind of being very circumspect about what you're saying. Anyway, yeah, spending some downtime after army service, get the fuck out of here. Dissertations, monographs, and articles abound about the way in which Asian religions have taken root in Israeli secular life. That was the other point, DE, about to what you were saying. Like, I think really, really what it speaks to is a very hard, I'm not an expert on Israel by any means, but as I understand it, there's a really hard division and growing division between the state of the Zionist entity as a secular enterprise and which serves the interests of ethnic, largely secular or at least kind of, you know, incompletely religious Jews versus, yes, there's a very heavy religious infrastructure, but those people don't serve in the army. And, yeah. You know,
I mean, that's like such an a strong internal contradiction that makes this untenable in the long run.
Right. Continues, Orthodox rabbis even feel the need to comment upon it as a phenomenon that they feel threatens the Jewish identity of Israelis who choose to follow those paths. Israel, and then they kind of just, this is a weird, I don't think this is really true, but whatever. Israel is a model for some on the Hindu right who see it as a state where a dominant religion can aspire to remain dominant without compromising democratic values. I mean, that is among the most ridiculous things I've ever, like, first of all, obviously Israel doesn't have any democratic values, whatever those are. Well, I guess they do to the extent, like when we say "quote unquote" democratic values, it just means like
democratic values. This is
democratic values are just like whatever Jews want, right? So, like from the perspective of like, yeah, democratic values means whatever Jews want. So, in that sense, yes. But in terms of like actual, you know, popular whatever he wants,
yeah, no, hell no.
Yeah. Hell no. And the, I guess what they're talking about is like the BJP and the RSS, which are kind of in, which are, you know, historic kind of, you could say, Hindu nationalist organizations in India, but they're not really like, I mean, Indian democracy is its whole, a whole very complicated topic. And India is in some meaningful sense democratic. It's actually kind of, they have a really heavily enforced quota system because there's such a hodgepodge mess of just different languages and ethnicities, and there's a lot of really intense geographic and religious variation within India. And so in order to, you know, they try to like make sure everyone has a voice by essentially a very hard quota system, including a quota for women and all this kind of stuff. But like in certain important ways, you know, the like Modi and the BJP and Hindu nationalists, I mean, their critics aren't wrong when they point out that these people don't really believe in democracy. I mean, they do to the extent that, like, they recognize that if you don't, like, burn the pinch of incense to your quote-unquote democratic values, that Shlomo and the CIA are going to come after you. And they definitely don't want that. They want to play ball with the banking mafia and international finance and all this kind of stuff. They see it rightfully as, you know, crucial to India's continuing industrialization. But this idea that like Israel is not a model for the Hindu right, it's just not, like, that's just a ridiculous, I don't know where he's even getting that. And they don't really specify.
I have seen, you know, online, I don't know if it's all just bots. I assume some are like legitimate people, given that there's a billion of them to pick from. Just, you know, if you look under like YouTube comment sections or Twitter replies, you'll see Indian posters doing the Israeli Indian flag emojis and like India love Israel, greatest ally.
Yeah. I haven't seen that. I mean, like, all
AstroTurfed, or is there like some basis for this? I mean, I guess
Indians don't know what the fuck a Jew is. I mean, this was like, I don't want to like, Jazz and James did a great rundown a few months ago on the Israel Jew stuff. I mean, the India Jew stuff. But I will say, like, I mean, I guess it's true that probably in like the upper echelons of, you know, financiers, that like there's some recognition of what the, you know, they know like what a Jew is, and that they have money and that they can be valuable business partners, and they're probably not as woke as they ought to be with regard to that. But like, the average Indian has an IQ of like 80 and they don't know what the fuck a Jew is. It's just like they, you know, like,
when, you know, superpower by, let's see. Well, 7 weeks, weeks to superpower, 7 weeks left. Superpower.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. no, they, yeah.
So, but here's the thing, right? Like you're talking about people that, like, when the British were like, what do you think of the British leaving? And the average Indian was like, the British are here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, right. Like, they had no freaking clue, man. You're talking about completely endogamous societies that have been that way
for thousands of years, literally thousands of years.
Yeah, thousands of years, and they don't leave their spot.
No.
And if they do leave their spot, it causes everything to fall apart. Look at all the stuff that you see in the tech press about, like, caste discrimination inside the tech industry. It's like,
yeah, right, yeah, you know, they, like, still, like, they bring their behavior into Silicon Valley. Yeah,
right. And you know, like, the Indians were able to push the Jews out of the diamond business.
Yeah, that's a kind of underappreciated point. That like the Indians have their own, like in particular the Jains, which is like a kind of interesting religion. It's not Hinduism, it's not Buddhism. It's its own thing, and they are kind of like the Jews of India. They're a very, very small minority of extremely overrepresented, particularly in like the gold and diamond precious materials trade, middleman type stuff. They're, you know, very kind of tight knit and higher IQ than the surrounding population. And there's no place for Jews in India.
They really do be like that.
They really are. I mean, and they're vastly preferable. I will say Jains are much nicer people to deal with than your average Jew. But there's no like place for Jews in Israel. And I think in some ways, even more so than China, there's really like, I just have a very hard time imagining there's going to be any possibility for any kind of subversion in India by the Jews, because it's just they're not.
Well, India, I mean, not to, India is, itself is fake and gay.
Right.
I mean,
like, yes, exactly.
Like if you read, one of the best things you can do if you're in our thing is read Anthropology before it got paused.
Yes.
And if you read British Anthropology from like 1875, right, at the height of the empire, they had India taxonomically down to like, here are the marginal castes and here are the people that are like, yeah, you know, badasses that we could use for this. And here's the merchants we could use it for administrative stuff. And here's this and here's that. And you can just dip your toe in that. And that's all I've done is a very, very cursory reading. India is huge physically. You know, there's deserts, there's jungles, there's high mountains, there's all this, you know, this vast, you know, diversity of climates and peoples and all this other stuff. They have a complete society unto themselves, and they have the merchant middleman class, the Jains or certain Brahmin castes, or they have, you know, the Sikhs or the Gurkhas, or, you know, like, and other, you know, Muslim groups in them from the desert there. And like, they have all the badasses that they need. They have all the merchants that they need. They have everything unto themselves, and they know it, and they don't trust foreigners. Like, you know, the Jews can show up and be like, hi, I want to make money here, and they'll be like, that's great, but we don't trust you.
Exactly. And it doesn't compute. Yeah.
And it's not because they're Jews, it's just because they're not Indian. And it's very obvious.
It's partially though, because I mean, it's because it's, I mean, they're not quite, you know, Indian religious pluralism is kind of real to the extent that, you know, you have so many different cults in the kind of classical anthropological sense that you were using before. You just have different deities, different. I mean, Hinduism itself is kind of a 19th century invention in certain ways. It's. I mean, that's a kind of complicated and different topic. But you have such internal variation just within the religion you could call Hinduism. Really extreme, more so. I mean, it really boggles the mind. So the point is, like, you know, it's not that they would necessarily object. It's not like there's no room for religious outsiders at all, period. But this idea is like, you're going to come. Interestingly, Hinduism, to the extent you could talk about it as, you know, just Hinduism, in certain ways is a lot like Judaism, or specifically regarding the relationship between the religion and the land. Hinduism is really hard to export to places that aren't India, because it's so tied to, like, this mountain is where Shiva did this, or that tree is where, you know, like, Bhairab.
Nigga, how are you going to be Hindu without the Ganges?
Exactly. So, and so it's very, very tied to the specific geography, and in a way that kind of echoes Judaism in terms of being tied to this land in the Levant. So the idea that other people, you have these, like, you know, these people who are going to come and going to say, like, oh, we have this holy land over there, and it's actually where God did all this. I mean, it's just like, you'd be like, no, I'm sorry, I'm not going to listen to you. It just doesn't. Anyway, that's all kind of a tangent. I do want to go on, but the rumors of Israeli projected dominance of India are highly exaggerated.
It's entirely possible. All right. And here's the thing that is interesting. You know, Sarah Rao or whatever, like, I think the most annoying group of people in the world, or in our politics right now, besides Jews, are Brahmin women married to white dudes. right, that show up here and they're like, I'm oppressed because I'm brown. And it's like, you're a fucking Brahmin. Shut up.
Yeah.
Exactly. They're called turmeric monsters.
Well, they're just oppressed because you stink. Monsters. Take a shower.
Right. Like these people are absolutely insufferable. Like they might, they might even be worse than Jews, possibly. I will leave that up to the audience to decide. But anyway, now the problem with these people is that they're good at playing the ethnic game.
Yes.
And they're absolutely ruthless about it. And so the idea that the Jews can just show up and be obviously foreign. I mean, when I was growing up, like I didn't know, like Jews were, to me, were just another religion, and they had the same skin tone as I did. Like, oh, like they just go to Jewish church. Okay. You know, that's the understanding that the average American has. There's very little way that like Jews could blend in to the Indian population and subvert them the way they've subverted Europeans. It's just not happening.
No.
And Indians here, you know, I've driven through, you know, when I moved, I drove through Canada, and there were freaking Patels running the hotel in the ruralest parts of Canada.
Damn.
like, dude.
How did you get here?
Exactly.
Who told you?
Exactly. Like, middle of nowhere.
This was supposed to be a secret that you weren't in on.
And yet they're here. And so, like, the idea, they have, like, the ethnic networks that are you know, widely dispersed, and they own the gas stations and the hotels and this and that. And they're going to edge the Jews out, man. And that's why the Republicans are like, we must get the Pajit vote, and we'll import, we can import a million a year for the rest of it.
No, please.
They've adopted a policy of seek and destroy.
that's a possible show title. All right. So I just want to, we got running a little low on time, so I just want to move on. So basically this relationship starts between Ben-Gurion and this guy because he sends him a letter. Ben-Gurion visits Burma. The Prime Minister of Burma comes to Israel on a state visit, meets Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion wants to get in touch with some Buddhist academics. He receives a letter from a Buddhist, I don't know how to pronounce like these Thai things. It's Nyanaponika Mahathera. He says, may I first introduce myself as a Buddhist monk of Jewish origin born in Germany. My late parents were Eastern Jews born in Galicia, Austria. I am 55 years of age and entered the Sangha in Ceylon 20 years ago under the well-known German monk scholar Nyanaponika Mahathera. I am now a citizen of Ceylon. A few days ago, a government official told me that his department had received a request of yours for Buddhist literature, blah, 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 blah. He says, in introducing himself as a simple monk, Nyanaponika Thera was being more than modest. By the 1950s reached the intellectual and clerical leadership of Theravada Buddhism. Now, that's really interesting. I mean, here you have an Eastern European Jew who rather quickly has reached the intellectual and clerical leadership of a Buddhist society.
A very long and traditional society. Like, that's impressive.
So I'm not going to like,
is like rapid.
I'm not going to sugarcoat that. I think that's a great kind of, you know, example of Jewish behavior and Jewish, you know, just how it
strategy.
How it be. Right. However, this really stuck out to me. And this was the point that kind of like, I was like leaping. I was reading. I was like, yes. See, at the letter's end, Thera mentions that he was once a Zionist, but as a young man, he felt that he had to choose between Zionism and Buddhism. Yes, he did. It is striking that nowhere in this initial letter does the monk use his given Jewish name. Only later would Ben-Gurion learn that Terah's name had been Sigmund Shlomo Feininger. One can only assume that with his vows to become a monk in the Theravada Buddhist tradition, Feininger gave up the use of his European Jewish name and never returned to it.
Excuse me, say what?
He gave up the use of his European Jewish name and never returned to it.
It was like Fei what?
Feiniger. Oh yeah, yeah. Well played. But I mean, here's the thing is, look, I don't know anything about, you know, his relationships. I don't want to cast aspersions without knowing anything. I will say that these clerical hierarchies in Buddhist monasteries tend to be extremely reactionary. And if they saw fit to, you know, include him in their upper echelons, I'm not going to doubt their wisdom in that personally. What I will say is it's absolutely noteworthy that despite being born a Jew, and despite, I mean, they kind of, the article goes in some ways.
I will absolutely doubt their wisdom.
Okay, fair enough.
That decision.
Fair enough. But I think the key point here is he understood that he could not be a Zionist and a Buddhist. He could not retain his Jewish identity and serve in the capacity that he wanted to serve as a religious functionary in a traditional Buddhist society, in a traditional Buddhist institutional structure. Yeah.
And shout out to Brother Nathaniel. You cannot be a Zionist and anything else.
That's correct. That's exactly
you
right.
You cannot be, you know, there are conversos who are, you know, Brother Nathaniel is a genuine Christian. Why? Because he hates Judaism.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Like, and any decent Buddhist would be like, this is not the Eightfold Path. This is
it's something else. And you see that.
It's not something else. Like I think a Buddhist and a Christian can sit down and be like, what did C.S. Lewis call it? He called it in one of his books, he talks about like the natural law and how the Buddhists and the Christians, everybody just got along, like everyone agreed on certain things. But Zionism is, and Judaism are exactly opposed to the truth, right? Like,
yes.
And so you and I could sit down and have a discussion about, and Nikkei could have a discussion. We could talk about like Roman, Western Christianity, Eastern Christianity, Buddhism. And there's a lot we'd actually just agree on. I mean, like I like to think that I'm friends with you guys, and despite our differences, like we agree on a lot of stuff. And, you know, the one thing that we don't, you know, like you get one Jew in there and they're going to be like, they completely disagree on everything because the nature of Judaism is like the Brahmin turmeric monster times a million.
it's egoism. I mean, I understand. I think there's value in analyzing it in purely secular terms, because at a certain level, it's a purely secular phenomenon in terms specifically as a group evolutionary strategy to attain global supremacy, global domination. Right. But there's also this aspect to it where it's the religion of the self. It's myself. It is the religion of self-advancement, of self-aggrandizement. And, you know, for Buddhism, there is no self. For Christianity, where's the soul, but it's not your ego. And the point is self-effacement. So the TLDR on that is, that's how I see, I think you can analyze it in metaphysical terms as well. We're running really short on time. So I want to just say one last thing on this point before we do our plugs, which is, apparently he wrote a book called The Heart of Buddhist Meditation, which I had heard of. I didn't realize he was the author. Tara's book, The Heart of Buddhist Meditation, deeply influenced many future Buddhist teachers in the West, including Jack Kornfield, Sylvia Boorstein, and John Kabat-Zinn. Guess what they all have in common?
Oh, my God.
And what's really funny is for people who hang around like the so-called mindfulness movement, secular mindfulness, Kabat-Zinn in particular founded this thing called the mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is just garbage. I mean, it's all garbage. And it's Judaism. It's just straight, like, it's stripped down, secularized. We're going to gut Buddhism of any of its actual, you know, real important content, and
we're gonna fix this for you, guy,
and make it Jew friendly as possible. Written by all these people are Jews, and package it for the Judaized Western secular environment, and that's what mindfulness.
Thanks to their culture of critique, man, they're like, hey, that's a nice tradition you got there. We have some comments we'd like.
And
to
it's
make.
The same thing they've done to the Catholic Church. It's the same thing they've done.
I was
to
just gonna bring that up.
Yeah, it's that's like, exactly. Hey, that was how I wanted to tie it back.
Holy
crap. The same exact thing they did to the Catholic Church, and going back to the discussion of gay marriage and Bergoglio and all this stuff. So, Yeah, you know, and they're trying to do it to Buddhism, which is why, I mean, why am I doing this? Why am I here? Why did I call myself, you know, Dharma King and I'm doing, you know, Stuttering Retard podcast? It's because I think it's extremely important to fight back against this. And we cannot allow the Jews to control the institutional structures or discourse of Buddhism in the West, period. End of story. Okay. Sorry to cut things a bit short, but we are running a little short on time. Did you all have anything, any final remarks quickly or otherwise anything to plug?
The media rapes kid.
I'm a Ridgeway kid. I'm a Ridgeway Democrat and I do not vote.
Fair enough. Based.
My plug is the Aggie White song. Google Aggie White voting on YouTube. Listen to that.
Is that a new one?
Attitude. It's from 2018, so it works for both elections.
All right, I haven't heard it yet, so I'm late to it, but I can't wait.
Yeah, that's my plug. And my plug also, get on Parler, put on a, get a burner phone number and get on there and bully side some conservatives.
DK, have you got an RSS for your video game podcast yet?
No, we are setting that up, and I'll plug that now. Yeah, we are doing we have the National Institute of Gamer Review, and we have I'll be dropping the second episode soon on the Halo series, so watch for that. I don't have an RSS yet, but as soon as we do, I will let you all know.
Listen to TYH.
Get an RSS, and I will.
Excellent. All right. And with that, we want to thank all our listeners. Thank you all for donating. We don't ask for donations, but we definitely appreciate them. Until next time, Mr. Producer, hail victory. See ya, Kyle. We'll be right back.
style is called Fuck Voting, because I'm so fucking sick and tired of this voting bullshit. I had fucking these old fat women wake me up 3 times a day. Fucking coming at my door, fucking knocking on my door, fucking ringing my doorbell and shit. Oh my god, I'm so fucking sick and tired of this bullshit. Fuck that shit. Hey, bitch, stop asking me to vote. I don't give a fuck, I'll punch you in the throat. Stop knocking on my door, I build a fucking moat. Trap door with a remote, no escape rope. Can't get out the cave zone, I don't pay taxes. I don't have an address. When I ask for coochie, I don't get no fucking access. Told a fast stripper, pop it for me like an abscess. I wasn't throwing cash, so they threw me out the premise. Damn, I'm a menace, never got my shot for tetanus. I don't got insurance, I don't go to the dentist. I buy Adderall from a kid who plays tennis. Now he can't pay attention, but we still ain't learn our lesson. No, I don't wanna fucking fly. Fuck that bitch in the suit, she's a fucking liar. I'ma be 200 years old and I can't retire. I don't wanna vote, bitch, I wanna start a fire and crack this fucking iron. Old people yelling me to vote, now I'm pressured. I run up to the ass and knock out the dentures. Bow, yeah. Hey, fat blue hair bitch calling on my phone. She asked me, do I vote? I ask her, can I phone? I ask if she's alone. I stroke my meat and moan. She stopped by and she sprayed her red X on my home. I'm out of control, and that's the way I like it. I'ma go crazy, player, I'ma start a riot. Channel 5 News, bring your helicopter pilot. I'ma play GTA, but I will not vote today. So stop asking, bitch. Stop asking, bitch. Fuck this shit! Stop fucking waking me up! I'm trying to fucking sleep at 2 o'clock in the afternoon! No, I'm not gonna vote. Fuck the politicians, fuck the media, fuck the news, fuck the journalists. You can all suck my dick and die slow, bitch. Fuck you.
Lumpin' pros. Lumpin' pros. Nihilism.
Oh.
Narcissism. Humiliation. Collapse. Carl Schmitt. Kaczynski. Graf. Christopher Lash. Nita Bohr.
Hyperreality.
Simulation. Simulacrum.